WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
August 15th through 17th marks the 20th anniversary of the Woodstock Festival. For two of the festival's originators, it took years before they could think of it as anything but the Woodstock Crisis, a crisis that ended with acres of mud, garbage, more than 70 lawsuits, and a huge debt. My guests Joel Rosenman and John Roberts financed the festival with their fledgling venture capital company. Their initial capital was from an inheritance Roberts came into at the age of 21. Rosenman and Roberts are still partners in their venture capital company. In 1974, they collaborated on a book about their Woodstock calamities called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. It's just been republished by Bantam. Their Woodstock story starts back when they were roommates in New York. Roberts was working on Wall Street. Rosenman was a lawyer who also had a club act. Neither of them liked their work. They were trying to think of alternatives when they came up with an idea for a TV sitcom.
It was about two young guys with a little bit more money, perhaps, than common sense, who were keen on getting into business deals. They had no idea about business. They were susceptible to making colossal and, we hoped, hilarious mistakes. And every week they would be extricated from one predicament or another by some miracle. We wrote up what's called in the business a treatment. It described the premise of the show. It got the characters pretty well delineated, and we took it to TV professionals who loved it. Unfortunately, we hadn't included any plot ideas because we didn't have the faintest idea about what business scrapes they might get into. And so in an effort to scare up some plot material, we took out a classified ad in the Wall Street Journal and in the New York Times describing, we hoped, these characters. Two young men with unlimited capital seek interesting and legitimate business propositions. Please write box number and so forth. Well, every con artist, criminal, crook, sharpie, and lunatic in creation put pen to paper, and thousands of responses poured in. Power sources from the eighth dimension, edible golf balls, weird singing woodchucks on tour in Canada. And sooner or later, Jock and I had amassed a number of these, what we called nut responses, for our TV show. And then one of those odd things happened in life. A response came in that interested us, in our naive way, in the business venture itself. Months later, we had jumped into our TV sitcom, become the characters, and found ourselves in a lunatic business venture called Woodstock.
Well, the people whose proposition you actually liked were two guys who had been in the record and concert promotion industry, and they had proposed setting up a studio in Woodstock near where Bob Dylan and the band were living. And then you all figured, well, why not do a concert, a benefit concert, to raise the money to fund the studio? And that's the concert that became Woodstock. What was the initial idea here? What did you envision the concert as being like?
Our first go-round, we hoped to get about 25,000 people. That was in, say, March of 1969. By mid-April, we realized we might actually attract 35 to 50,000. By, say, early June, we were looking at 75,000. By late July, we thought improbably enough that we were going to have 100,000. And by the day before the concert, we had everybody in America.
Was there a point where you realized this was not going to be about creating a studio in Woodstock? This was going to be just about this concert?
Yes, there was a point. In fact, it got increasingly obvious. So that even we eventually could see that we were not going to be making A, profits, B, we were going to be making probably history. And I think for sure, days and days before the start of the event, when already more people were sitting in the performance area as our audience than we had expected as a sellout crowd months before, they were there early just to get a good seat. We knew we were in trouble. And surely, when the event began and traffic backed down to Florida, it seemed to us, and people seemed to be coming in great huge tides and with no end, we knew that A, we weren't going to see no profits, and B, recording studio was just a fond dream.
My guests are John Roberts and Joel Rosenman, and they're the two who put on and who backed the Woodstock Festival 20 years ago, and they have a book about that experience that's just been reissued called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. Were you both in on booking the acts?
Booking the acts was done by professionals. We all were in on selecting the acts, and by all, I mean not just the four original concert promoters, but our girlfriends and friends and anybody we danced with at any time. We were open to ideas. We knew it was going to take a tremendous amount of talent to fill up all those hours. And that was even before we had extended the performance times when we saw how many people had arrived.
There's a lot of interesting behind-the-scenes stories in your book. One of them that interested me was this blackmail call that you got from a member of the New York Underground. And it turned out, I think, to be Abbie Hoffman?
It was Abbie Hoffman. Of course, we have a fairly unique and different perspective about Woodstock, having been, as it were, in the boiler room constructing and running this particular operation. And most people don't know about that story, and it's in the book. But the Underground had hoped that, the Radical Underground, I should say, had hoped that Woodstock would be a forum for their political ideas, that we would give them time on stage, that we would allow them to have booths, distribute leaflets, and so on. And it had been our very firm intention to keep this as non-political as possible. This was 3 days of peace and music. Abbie Hoffman summoned us down to his headquarters down in Greenwich Village in New York and announced that if we did not come across with some money and some stage time and booths and so on, that he was going to make our life a misery. Nothing he could do could have made our lives more miserable than they were by that July. We'd already been kicked out of our first site. So we said, essentially, do your worst.
Which was what?
Well, his worst turned out to be he jumped up on stage during the Who's performance and was booted off unceremoniously by Roger Daltrey. Later on, I think he did manage to distribute some leaflets. But that weekend stayed, at least for the course of the weekend, resolutely non-political. It was just 500,000 people trying to have a good time.
Well, you had hoped to make a big profit on Woodstock, and you had printed up plenty of tickets, but the festival ended up a free festival, and this is how the announcement of the free festival sounded on stage.
This is one thing that I was going to wait a while before we talked about, but maybe we'll talk about it now so you can think about it, because we all have to make some kind of plans for ourselves. It's a free concert from now on. That doesn't mean that anything goes. What that means is we're going to put the music up here for free. Now, let's face a situation. We've had thousands and thousands of people come here today. Many, many more than we knew or even dreamt or thought would be possible. We're going to need each other to help each other to work this out, because we're taxing the systems that we have set up. We're going to be bringing the food in. But the one major thing you have to remember tonight, when you go back up into the woods to go to sleep, or if you stay here, is that the man next to you is your brother. And you damn well better treat each other that way, because if they don't, then we blow the whole thing. But we've got it right there.
Well, in fact, the story of how this got to be a free concert has a lot more to do with fear than benevolence. Would you tell the story of why you were forced to make Woodstock a free festival?
Okay, it's even somewhat of a misnomer as described here.
You mean because some people had already paid? Yeah.
Well, for some people, it was not a free festival.
Yeah.
Those unfortunate few who actually bought tickets, many of whom never were able to get to the festival because of the traffic. It certainly wasn't a free festival for John and me. It cost us roughly $3 to $4 million. But it was certainly a free festival in the legend of Woodstock, and it was definitely a free festival for the hundreds of thousands that we just heard in the background while John Morris was making his announcement from the stage.
Now, you had hoped to have, what, about 20 turnstiles that ticket holders would walk through?
We had them. We built them. The gates were up. The turnstiles were up. Ticket takers had been identified, and, in fact, their uniforms had been designed. It was really all set. Unfortunately, all of that had been constructed in Wallkill, New York, some weeks prior to the actual event. And with roughly 34 days to go, the Zoning Board of Appeals of Wallkill met one evening in response to local pressure and revoked permits that we had had for months while we finished our construction. So an entire festival construction, at great expense and effort, was out the window. We were booted from that site, and with a little more than 5 weeks to go, we had to reconstruct the entire festival site in White Lake, New York. Now, this meant that some things had to be done triple time. Overtime was very expensive, even in those days. We hired a lot more staff. We had a thousand people working at our peak, trying to recreate the festival. A couple of days before the event was supposed to start, it really came down to, do we finish the stage, or do we try to get the stage even workable, or do we build fences and ticket gates once again? At that point, it kind of was put to John and me. Are we still in this for the money? Do we take a chance with the crowd? Do we take a chance with what may be the peaceful outcome of the festival, which we had worked so hard to maintain throughout the promotion period? We thought about it for a millisecond, I think, and said, build the stage, make sure the crowd is taken care of, make sure the systems are in place to support them, and we'll worry about taking tickets later.
Now, you had planned to have a lot of off-duty New York City police to come and keep the peace at the festival. At the last minute, the police reneged on the offer because the person who had made the offer got a heart attack and his replacement didn't think it was a very wise idea. But while you were still planning on using the New York City off-duty police,
yes.
What kind of deal did you have with them? Were they going to bus people for doing illegal things like smoking marijuana and dropping LSD or walking around naked?
No, they weren't. We had rather extensive interviews and rehearsals with the off-duty policemen that we selected. In fact, we had applicants, I think over 1,000 applicants for about 300 places. And we would pose questions to them, such as, if a young man with long hair comes up to you over the course of the weekend and blows marijuana smoke in your face, what is the correct reaction? If the policeman said, I'd take my nightstick and whop him one, then we would look for another candidate. If he said, I'd smile and walk away, then we probably had the right guy. What we wanted there was not a group of people to bust the crowd. We wanted people who were tolerant, who would keep the peace, who would see that people did not hurt each other, and who basically had bought into the dream and the idea of 3 days of peace and music.
What did you do for replacements?
Well, believe it or not, most of them showed up anyway. And it was really quite amusing because they didn't use their real names. They would sign in as Mickey Mouse or Pluto or Batman or something like that. And matching up Batman with the money he was owed was, as I recall, one of the more interesting tasks after the festival. So I would say of the 300 we hired, over 250 actually showed up, and they did a fine job.
The first night of the Woodstock Festival, that Friday night, there was a terrible thunderstorm. On stage, it sounded something like this.
It looks like we're going to get a little bit of rain, so you better cover up. If it does, if we should have a slight power problem, just cool it out. We'll sit here with you. We'll be okay.
Everybody get out!
And let's keep it nice and cool.
Well, while that was happening, behind the scenes, you were all worrying about mass electrocution. What had happened electrically that was the worry?
It was a nightmare. We had been... it really was... It probably was the bleakest moment of the festival for me. We were sprouting walkie-talkies from every ear at that point and dealing with a dozen problems every minute or two. And on top of it all, the phone rang. The chief electrician was calling from backstage. I asked him what the problem was. He sounded pretty shaky, actually, at the time, even for a man who was going through what he was going through. He said, with the rain and all of those hundreds of thousands of feet scuffling over the performance area, the main feeder cables supplying electricity to the stage, the musicians, the amplifiers, whatever, have been unearthed. And with additional abrasion from these sneakers and whatever and sandals, it may wear away the insulation on these cables. I'm worried with all those wet bodies packed together that we may have something approximating a... And he paused for a moment, and I couldn't believe that he was searching for the words that he came up with, but he came up with mass electrocution. I thought to myself, this is incredible. This can't be happening. He said, what do you want me to do? Should I shut down the power to the stage? Now, we had a philosophy there at headquarters that one of the reasons that this festival was proceeding so well, in spite of the adversities that everybody there was facing, the weather, the tremendous crowds, the strain on all facilities, was that the music was so mesmerizing. It was wonderful talent, brilliant artists performing, the kids were just in love with it. The thought of shutting the power down in the darkness, in the rainstorm, struck me as an invitation to chaos. Nevertheless, the thought of a mass execution posed additional moral problems. At that point, I remember breaking a two-year moratorium on smoking. I think I lit up three or four Camels at once and stuck them in my mouth and tried to think this one through. Finally, the electrician helped me out. He said, look, I think there's a chance that in the next 20 minutes I can work a shunt from the power source to the stage that bypasses those main feeder cables, and maybe that'll solve the whole problem. I said, give it a try, and hung up. And for the next 20 minutes, John and I sat there looking at each other. I guess we were waiting, like in the movies, for the lights to dim a little bit, the way they do when they throw the switch in the electric chair chamber. And I think it probably took 100 years for those 20 minutes to pass. The phone rang, and it was the chief electrician again. He said, I did it. Everything's fine.
When Woodstock was over, there were 70 legal proceedings against you. Would you list some of them?
Sure. I think you subtracted about 10, but
we
appreciate it. They ranged from local farmers suing us for $93.38 because their cows didn't give milk for 2 weeks, and we had a lot of sympathy with that, and I think we paid that right up front, to the proprietor of Monticello Racetrack, whose patrons couldn't get in on Friday night because the road was blocked. The food concessionaire ultimately sued us because he said we did not provide enough security for him, and so on and so forth. So I think, and landholders, of course, sued us because while we had rented most of the land in the area that we could find, that was in the expectation there'd be 120,000 people there. When 500,000 showed up, they inevitably spilled over into some land we hadn't rented, and those people wanted compensation.
Did most of the people who filed against you win?
No, in fact, none of them did. We never lost a lawsuit. We willingly settled a couple of the landholder lawsuits because we felt that was right, but we didn't lose a lawsuit. We turned out, and we believed ourselves, not to be culpable for a good many of the things that we were sued for. But I think people thought we were an easy touch. We'd been spending money like water all weekend, and the word got out that there were deep pockets there, and they came after us. In fact, of course, we cleaned up everything. We made everyone whole. We spent a great deal of money restoring Max Yasger's alfalfa field to its former pristine condition, and this was an event that was never tarnished in any way by anyone remaining unpaid.
My guests are John Roberts and Joel Rosenman, the two backers of the Woodstock Festival and authors of a book about it called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. It's amazing that you've both stayed together for the past 20 years. What are some of the... You still have your venture capital business, I take it?
Yes, we do.
What are some of the things you've funded, some of the successful projects that actually made money that you've funded over the years?
Well, we've funded a number of different venture capital projects, including some what are called mergers and acquisitions projects. None of them was as famous as Woodstock, thank goodness, and none of them worked out, fortunately, the way Woodstock did financially. Recently, we acquired a company that manufactures ribbons and gift wrapping and then sold it to management. A little while ago, we bought a chain of retail stores selling variety goods, something like hardware and farmers' products to gentlemen and country farmers, and then sold that to management. We have a stake in a candy manufacturer, and we had for a while a position in a shoe company, and we've done a number of other less conventional startups, including recently our financing of a search for sunken treasure in the Turks and Caicos Islands, looking for doubloons from Spanish galleons in the 15th and 16th centuries.
We still have some screws loose, in other words.
How much money did you finally lose on Woodstock?
Well, the movie and records finally produced enough by way of royalties for us to break even around 1980. Subsequent to 1980, we have had some revenues from that, so you might say that we're in a profit position, except that we have had to use those revenues to protect the various trade and service mark applications and filings that we have. There is a misconception about Woodstock that not only was it a free concert, but that Woodstock belongs to the world. In fact, not to put too fine a point on it, it belongs to us, and we've registered it as a mark in Washington.
I thank you both very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Terry.